session of January 12, 1977. I'll begin in those conditions. No light, no microphone. Just right now, as I begin this new lecture course, I'm very unhappy to see so many people standing. This is really negative. No need for you to keep standing there. I'm really embarrassed that you are standing. You're very uncomfortable. Do as you want. As I begin this new lecture course, I am thinking about a Nietzschean opposition, one that Deleuze brings to light in his book on Nietzsche. It's an opposition between method and culture. In a Nietzschean perspective, method presupposes what Deleuze calls the goodwill of the thinker, that is, a premeditated decision. In actual fact, it's a mean by which we avoid going to a particular place, or by which we maintain the option of escaping from it, escaping from the thread of the labyrinth. Indeed, in the so-called human sciences, like positive semiology, the method, I myself have been obsessed by it, means two things. First, a manner of proceeding toward the goal, a protocol of operations with a view to achieving an end. For example, a method for decoding, explaining, describing exhaustively. Secondly, following the etymology, the idea of a straight path that wants to head straight toward a goal. Paradoxically, the straight path actually marks out places the subject doesn't want to go to. In the strict sense of the term, a method risks fetishizing the goal as a place. And as a result, by ruling out all other places, the method enters into the service of a generality, a morality, as Kierkegaard equates generality with morality. The subject renounces what he doesn't know of himself, renounces his irreducibility, abdicates his force, to say nothing of his unconscious. Culture, for Nietzsche, is not a humanist or ironic meaning. It's violence undergone by thought. Culture is a training undergone by thought through the action of selective forces. A training that brings the whole unconscious of the thinker into play. Culture is what the Greeks called paideia. And they didn't speak of method, training, force, violence. Those words are not to be taken in the highly charged sense. It would be necessary to go back to Nietzsche's idea of force. Is not the place to go over it again, as the engendering of a difference. The person can be placed, civilized even, and still situate themselves within a paideia. For me, culture as training is not method, but evokes the image of a kind of dispatching along an eccentric path, scrambling among snatches between the bounds of different fields of knowledge, flavors. Paradoxically, when understood in this way, as the registering of forces, culture is hostile to the idea of power, which is in method. Culture is not exactly paideia. The will to force is not a will to power. Here then, there will be my hypothesis. It's a matter of culture, not of method. Don't expect anything on method other than in Mallarmé's sense of the word, a fiction, language reflecting on language. The practice of culture is, if you want, an attentiveness to forces. Now, the first force I'm able to investigate, to interpolate, the one I can see at work within myself, even through the illusions of the imaginary. It is the force of desire, or to be more precise, the figure of fantasy. Fantasy is to ask that we can inquire into a science of fantasy. Science and fantasy have to be put in relation as Bachelard would have it, the intrication of science and the imaginary in the 18th century. Bachelard showed the implication of science and fantasy. There is a certain moralism of Bachelard. The basis of science for him is the decantation of fantasies. Without contradicting that, it could be said that no separation occurs. Rather, the superimposing of fantasy and science, let's be clear that our starting point will be prior to that decanting process. The fantasy is the origin of culture. The fantasy is at the root of the engendering of forces and differences. I will not be dealing with the phalanstery in my fantasy of living together in general. Despite the fact that the phalanstery is clearly a phantasmatic form of living together for Fourier at least. Fourier had a very strong fantasy of the phalanstery. It doesn't spring from an opposition to solitude, but on the contrary, from a fondness for solitude. I like being alone, he repeats. Therefore, the fantasy isn't a counter-negation, it's not the reverse, it's not the site of a frustration experienced as its opposite. A fantasy is a positive scenario. It states the positives of desire. It knows only positives. Phantasmatically speaking, there's nothing contradictory about wanting to live alone and wanting to live together. This is the main topic of my course. Then still, apropos of Fourier. Utopia is rooted in a certain day-to-day existence. The more vivid the subject's everyday life, to his own mind, the more potent, the more elaborately detailed the utopia. Fourier is a better utopianist than Plato. So what was everyday life like in Fourier's utopia? Two of Fourier's commentators, Armand and Maublanc, pinpointed it exactly, while a third, Desroches, was outraged by it, misguidedly, of course. The phalanstery is a paradise conjured up by an old habitué of table d'hôte and brothels for his own personal use. Desroches was, of course, indignant and attacked the phalanstery. Of course, table d'hôte, brothels, all those sorts of places are excellent utopian material. This is how we can fantasize a certain living together. Third remark, there is further evidence of the phantasmatic force of living together. Living together harmoniously, cohabitating harmoniously, this is what fascinates most about other people. This is what inspires the most envy. Couples, groups, even I might say families, when they are getting along well together. Is it myth? Is it an illusion in its most basic form? This is the right sort of material for a novel. We'd had no families at all when one or two that got along well together. Fourth, I said that the fantasy is not the contrary of its rational, logical opposite, but it's possible for fantasy to count contain counter-images, negative fantasies within itself, like an opposition between two phantasmatic images, two scenarios, but not between an image and reality. For instance, being shut up for all eternity with those irritating people sitting at the next table in a restaurant, that would be a hellish image of living together. Sartre, huis clos. Another horrible fantasy of living together, being an orphan and then discovering you have a commoner for the father, therefore a rotten family, alone in the world, sans famille. You discover at some point you have a good father, you come from a good family. Is it a sovereign good family? From the perspective of psychoanalysis, this is the ultimate fantasy. This is Freud's Familien Roman. 5. As a fantastical digression, it goes without saying that we'll be thinking of living together as an essentially spatial fact, living together in the same space. But in its most basic form, living together is also temporal. Here, we need to tick this box, living at the same time as, living in the same time as, contemporaneity. For example, I can truthfully say that for 27 years, Marx, Mallarmé, Nietzsche, and Freud lived together for 27 years. What's more, it would have been possible to orchestrate a meeting in some Swiss town or other in, say, 1876, giving them an opportunity which would have been the ultimate sign of living together, to talk together. This fantasy of contemporaneity is to alert us to what seems to me a very complex, insufficiently studied phenomenon, contemporaneity. Who are my contemporaries? Whom do I live with? It's no use asking the calendar, as our little chronological game makes clear, unless it's only now that they are becoming contemporaries. Something to be explored further, the effects of the directional lines of chronology. See, for instance, optical illusions. Chronology would be an optical illusion. Perhaps then we'd come up against this paradox, an unexpected link between the contemporary and the untimely, like the encounter between Marx and Mallarmé, Mallarmé and Freud around the table of time. That's a really weird image. Well, that's it. I now come to my fantasy. I call fantasy something like a psychoanalytic image, a resurgence of certain images, certain desires. Often they only come through a particular word. That word is a key signifier and leads from the fantasy to an investigation. Fantasy is for me like a mine, an open quarry. Fantasy, wanting to be identified, has nothing to do with the topic of the last 2 years, the lover's discourse. You shouldn't believe that after having discussed the lover's discourse, I'm now discussing the fantasy of living together as a consequence. There's nothing to do with each other. This seminar was not the exploitation of a fantasy. Here, what I am trying to get at is the case of two people living together. It's now what I want to discuss, a fantasy of a life, a regime, a lifestyle, dieta, diet. We don't have a word for that. It's neither dual nor plural, a collective in Greek. Dieta in Greek. In French, it became diet, diet in English. A diet is a regime of life. It's neither dual nor plural. It's something like solitude with regular interruptions. The paradox, the contradiction, the aporia of bringing distances together. I'll start missing the other room we were before. This is really too bad. Yeah, we tried to find somebody to help us. Good. I was saying that the aporia was the idea of putting in common differences. This would be the utopia of a socialism of distance. That's would be about strong and gregarious ages, such as the Renaissance, about which Nietzsche speaks of a pathos of distance. Now it was in the course of a chance reading, a book by Lacarrière, L'été grec, the Greek summer, that I encounter the fantasy of the world that would set it to work. This takes place on Mount Athos. On this mountain, we have Cenobitic convents in which monks are both isolated from and in contact with one another within a particular type of structure. I'll describe the features of that structure later on. I can say simply that it's based on idiorhythmic clusters, means that each subject lives according to his own rhythm. You need two R's for idiorhythmic. Let's be clear that for such a fantasy to happen, we require a setting, a scenario, therefore a place. Athos, where I've never been, conjures up a mix of images. It gave me a stage. Images. The Mediterranean Sea, the terrace, the mountain. In a fantasy, we erase the dirt, we erase the faith. Basically, the scenario is a landscape. I can picture myself there, standing on the edge of a terrace, the sea in the distance, the coarse white plaster on the walls, with two rooms for my own use, two more for a few friends, somewhere to come together for the library. This is my idiorhythmic fantasy. Idiorhythmic, this was the word that transmuted the fantasy into a field of knowledge. Through that word, I gain access to things that can be learned, which is not to say I was able to learn them. Bibliographically speaking, my research has often been disappointing. For instance, I learned virtually nothing from the monastic forms of idiorhythmy, the béguinage, the solitaries of Port-Royal, all those small communities. I'll come back to the dominance of religious models. What matters for me is that in idiorhythmic there is rhythm. And we need to remember Benveniste's important article on the notion of rhythm in problems and general linguistics. It's a marvelous demonstration. In Greek, rhythmos is usually related to the verb rain, which means to flow. For a long time, there was a semantic trajectory. Rhythm would have come from the regular movement of the waves. But Benveniste demystifies this, the idea of flowing. Now, the history of the world is different. Its origins are to be found in ancient Ionian philosophy. For the creators of atomism, Leucippus, Democritus, this was a technical term. Prior to the Attic period, rhythmos never meant rhythm. It was never applied to the regular movement of the waves. The actual meaning is rather a distinctive form, a proportioned figure, an arrangement. It's both very close and very different from schema. Schema means a fixed and fully developed form that's set down like an object, a statue, an orator, or choreographical figure in tragedy. Rhythmos is opposed to schema. Rhythmos is the pattern of a fluid element. It's mobile, it's unimprovised, it has no consistency. The fleeting form of a fluid element, a letter, a peplum, a mood. One can speak of rhythmos about the mood of somebody. It's an improvised form. For the Ionian atomists, rhythmos is one manner in which atoms can flow. It's a configuration without fixity or natural necessity. It's a flowing. In the musical sense, we have the modern use, but you find it only in Plato. What interests me here is this idea of idiorhythm is almost a tautology, a pleonasm. Rhythmos is by definition individual. It's the way in which a subject places himself or herself in the social code. Rhythmos sends us back to the subtle forms of ways of life, moods, unstable configurations, phases of depression or elation, in short, the exact opposite of an inflexible, implacable, regular cadence. It's because rhythm acquired a repressive meaning, if you refer to the life rhythm of a Cenobite, a Phalansterian, whose activities are scheduled to the nearest quarter of an hour, then indeed you needed to add the prefix idios. Idios is opposed to rhythm, but idios is rhythmos in the original sense. In its original setting, atos, idiorhythmi indicates the proportions of the fantasized community. Therein lies its advantage. its enabling force for me. Proportions leads to an ontology, the being of an object. We could have a theory of architecture that would be a theory of proportions. We know very well that if we blow up a detail of a painting, we will see those proportions, as in Cézanne or Nicolas de Staël. Proportion has a foundational value. To ask about proportion is to go to the core of the issue. It cuts through a highly lit scene. And this is the idiorhythmic proportion. It's a little what you would see in a postcard, as it were. Fantasy is like that, a clear, powerful, unwavering projector that isolates the brightly lit stage whereupon desire installs itself, leaving either side of the stage in shadows. Can we continue the question of idiorhythmic life with couples? But that's not the issue. The fantasy is not interested in the inevitable fixture of the bedroom, in the cloistering and in the legality, legitimacy of desire. We want to investigate the setting of the couple. The apartment, with its focus on the bedroom, can't be idiorhythmic. It's a little like the linguistics society. When it was founded, putting it into the statutes themselves, it took the decision not to accept papers on the origins of language. In the same way, we should decide not to talk about couples, or only talk about couples in the context of larger groups, in outdoor settings. In addition, the family system blocks any experience of anachoresis, of idiorhythmy. In modern-day communes, the commune falls apart from the moment family groups are re-established. This is due to the conflict between sexuality and the law. On the other side of the fantasy, we have macro-groupings, large communes, phalansteries, convents, cenobitism. Why? I mean, why doesn't the fantasy encounter these larger forms? It's obvious the structure is based on an architecture of power, and they are openly hostile to idiorhythmy. Historically speaking, it's for precisely this reason, in opposition to idiorhythmy, that such structures get established, that they have been established. I refer you to the fundamental humanity of Fourier's phalanstery, with its timing of each and every quarter hour. It's the exact opposite of idiorhythmy, much closer to barracks, to boarding schools. We could say again that what the fantasy is looking for, looking to highlight, is a zone that falls between two excessive forms. First, an excessively negative form, solitude, eremitism, then an excessively assimilative form, the secular or non-secular connubium. There would be a median, utopian, Edenic, idyllic form. That's the life in common. This would be idiorhythmy. It's an eccentric form. It's never really caught on in the church, on Mount Athos, through disaffiliation. In fact, the church always resisted it. Saint Benedict, the Sarabites, who were monks living in groups of two or three, the satisfaction of desires. You have this on Mount Athos, through the notion of disaffiliation. It is the disaffiliation of idiorhythmy. For example, psychoanalysis has never really engaged with the question of small groups. What interests the psychoanalytic discourse is either the subject with his familiar straitjacket or the crowd. With the exception of Wilfred Ruprecht Bions, it's in English, W.R. Bion, translated into French, Experiences in Groups, from 1961, is very specific. Little groups in a hospital setting is not an especially lucid book. To conclude here, idiorhythmy leads neither to the monastery nor to the family, the idea being to avoid those grand repressive forms. To bring this introduction to idiorhythmy to a close, I shall present a trait that seems to me characteristic of the problem in a localized manner. From my window, December 1st, 1976, I see a mother pushing an empty stroller, holding a child by the hand. She walks at her own pace, imperturbably. The child, meanwhile, is being pulled, dragged along, is forced to keep running like an animal, like one of Sade's victims being whipped. She walks at her own pace, unaware of the fact that her son's rhythm is different. She exerts here power, the mother's power. This is the subtlety of power. Power is effected through dysrhythmy, through heterorhythmy. I still have time to talk about monachism. I want to say a few things about monks. Yes, what I meant is that the forces by which a fantasy attains to or opens out onto culture will not act in a straightforward manner. They are subject to unforeseen tensions. For example, the fantasy of a free life lived among just a few other people, which is the idiorhythmy of Mount Athos, can identify themes, traits, structures of that form that might in turn shed light on contemporary issues. religious idiorhythmy should allow us to understand our times today and also personal issues. These are not general, cultural, sociological issues like those of communities or communes, but these are more idiolectical issues, things I see happening around me in my friends' lives, things that really apply to my life. You might expect that the direction of our research will be that of an affective psychology, the relation to other people, to the other. But at this point, it actually takes an unexpected detour. The crystallizing word, ethos, sets me reading. My readings about monks in a handful of novels were fascinating. It's surely a fantasy, but there's no conversion from me to monastic spirituality. There was already an unsettling investment in monastic material. Then there is another tension. The fantasy visibly recoils from Cenobitism, life in a convent. The reading adventure, my exploration, turns away from Western Cenobitism or from the Benedictine model of the 6th century, starts getting interested in pre-Cenobitic forms, eremitic, semi-anachoretic forms in which we see idiorhythmy. We can live like anachorets, but not too far from one another. It's closer, in fact, to Oriental monachism, such as you find in Egypt, Constantinople. And this is in this way that we can work our way back to ethos. About this, I'd like to give you a few details about dates. I'll end up with this. I'll give you a few dates to leave you something clear. It's a sort of general scheme that I have here on the blackboard. So we have Diocletian 275. 305, end of the 3rd century, Anthony in the desert, eremitism. First line. Diocletian, the emperor who persecuted the Christians, end of the 3rd century, 275, 305. It's the moment of Anthony in the desert. the corresponding institution is eremitism. Then, second line, the conversion of Constantine, 313, beginning of the 4th century. Here we find anachorites around Anthony in the Sinai. And here we have indeed semi-anachoritism corresponding to my sense of idiorhythmy. It's the first and best image of idiorhythmy at the beginning of the 4th century. Finally, 314, we have the very important phenomenon of Pachomius, who founds Cenobitism, the first convents. Then the turning point, 380, when Christianity becomes the religion of the state, end of the 4th century, 5th century, and there is the split between the Western and the Eastern systems. This is the moment of Saint Augustine's conversion, and this is the rule of Saint Augustine. This text will, for centuries, underpin a whole set of beliefs in the 5th century. At that time, you also have the curious phenomenon of the stylites, that is, people who sit on a column. In the 6th century, we move on to Saint Benedict on Mount Cassin, first monasteries in the West, beginning of Western Cenobitism around 534. Finally, it's a little outside my scheme, but let's recall that in the 10th century, we have Laure, Laura, and also founded on Mount Athos. There was recently a very interesting collection of essays on Mount Athos. Finally, a last remark. If I gave this little scheme, I'm just showing the gaps in my culture. I might suggest that everything was played out around the 4th century. Cenobitism was a liquidation of anachoritism that was found to be too dangerous. Eremitism, semi-anachoretic, and idiorhythmy were considered dangerous marginalities. They resisted integration into a power structure. This is led to the shift to Christianity as a state religion. When Christianity acquired that status, the shift from no power, disempowerment, to power is the most important date. 350, 380, 380, the date of Theodosius' edict, the most important one in the history of our world. This was a radical shift in power and ideology. Christian religion was on the side of power. This is it. We'll see the rest next week.